talking hockey right now. Sportsnet 960, The Fan.
Right now we go via the Subway Restaurant's Fresh Take Hotline all the way to Italy to say hello to Calgary's Jeff Glass. Morning, Jeff.
Morning, guys. How you doing?
Fantastic. What the heck are you doing in Italy?
Well, the KHL likes to explore this time of year, so we're having our training camp in Aosta, Italy right now, and I can't complain. It's beautiful here.
So are you up near Austria in the mountainous part, or are you down by Rome in the waters of the Adriatic? Where are you?
No, we're right up in the mountains. It's beautiful here. It reminds me something of Banff or something like that back home, so they like the thin mountain air up here to train us in, and I can't complain.
So how long have you been doing this in terms of heading to Italy? Because to me, I'm looking at your resume here. This is your first year with a new KHL team. You've been in the league since 09-10, but have you been to Italy for a training camp before?
No, usually we go to Switzerland or Germany or somewhere like that, but this is my first time to Italy. It's been fantastic so far. We've actually been here about 3 days. We started the training camp right in Russia, in Togliatti. And then we move training camp here. We're going to play a couple exhibition games and then move on to Switzerland before heading back to Russia.
So where is Togliatti, the team that you're playing for in Russia?
Well, it's in the middle of nowhere. I'm sure Russians wouldn't think that way, but it's right in the heart of, it's about 1,000 kilometers east of Moscow.
Wow.
It's a working city. It's a blue-collar city. I haven't seen much of it. Like you said, it's an expansion club, so this is their first year in the league, and I'm new to the city as well, but I'm learning.
Now, you were a part of Canada's World Junior Gold Medal-winning team in 2005. You played your junior hockey in Kootenay, an Ottawa Senators draft pick, and you were in Binghamton for 4 years in the American Hockey League. When did you head over to the KHL, and what were your thoughts before you got there?
I headed over, just like you said, after 4 years at Binghamton. I was going to become a restricted free agent, and I wasn't qualified by Ottawa. So the offer came up to come over for a one-year deal to play in the KHL. And at the time, I wanted to take it as one step at a time and play 1 year. And I heard the stories, and for sure, I was pretty young to head over at that time. I think I was about 23, and it was a little bit maybe out of the ordinary. But I came over, I took it 1 year at a time, and 6 years later, I'm still here. So it's hard to complain. It's been real good to me, and I really enjoy it.
You have become an elder statesman, a wise man for which to talk to, I'm sure, for many guys that are kicking the tires on going over to Russia. How many calls do you get every off season?
Yeah. Between me and my wife, we field questions all summer about food, the living conditions, to planes, to you name it. But that's part of the gig, and we actually enjoy. There's an import rule where you can only have 5 or 6 imports per team. And to get over a good group of people on your team is pretty important. So I always like helping guys out, especially if they're coming to my squad, and make my year easier and make their year easier.
All right, so take us back to 2009-10. You played for a bunch of different teams in the K. Maybe walk us through your resume, where you've played, and maybe how the cities or the teams compare and contrast against each other.
Sure. Yeah, so my first 3 years I spent in Kazakhstan, actually. I was playing for a team in Astana. It's not the capital of Kazakhstan, but it's the newest city they built there, and it's they call it Small Dubai. It's a beautiful city that's been built in the last 10 years, and it comes up quick, so there's a few building errors and learning curves and whatnot you want to call it with the city. But because the team wasn't in Russia, there's actually no rule on how many imports you're allowed on the team. So we had 7 guys from outside of Russia on the team, which made the transition super easy for me, and we had a couple good years there, and I got to meet a couple guys that were really, really helpful in my development in the KHL. And from there, I moved on to a town, Novosibirsk, which is right where it sounds, right in the middle of Siberia. And I played one season there, and it was actually one of my best years in the KHL. It was cold. There wasn't much to do, but they loved their hockey there. And, you know, it'd be similar to a Calgary or Edmonton where people absolutely love the hockey and do anything for the hockey, and the town kind of revolves around the team. So I really enjoyed my season there, and from there I signed in Moscow with the team Spartak Moscow. It was a 2-year deal, and I'm not sure many people are probably too familiar with this, but the team had to be shut down partway through last season due to financial, our sponsor got shut down due to fraudulent banking and all sorts of fun stuff like that. So from there, the story gets to take a little bit of a turn, and I transferred from Spartak Moscow to CSK Moscow Red Army, and I finished the season there, just down the street, and which led me to having to sign this year in Lada Toliati, and that's the short version of a really, really long story.
Hey, that's a lot of stickers on the suitcase. That's pretty cool. What would be if someone said, "I've never been to Russia"? What's Russia like as a country? How do you answer that question?
Well, it's different. It's different, and I don't ever mean to offend Russians or the people or the towns, but it's totally different than what we're used to in Canada, especially. And the way they think is different. The food's different, and just the way they do things is just different. And the first couple of years, I'm very lucky. I was kind of eased into it because it can really be a culture shock is the best way to put it. But once you get the hang of it and you start to understand a little bit why they think the way they think, they're hardworking people that mean well and they're obviously dedicated to the sport. But I would never recommend people to come to Russia and just tour around like you would in Barcelona or something like that. You probably won't enjoy yourself. But after getting to know the culture a little bit, it's not so bad.
Now, you said your wife, has she been with you since day one on the journey to Kazakhstan, or was that later on that she started coming over with you in season?
Well, year one, she came back and forth. We did a little bit of long distance that year. Like I said, it was a first year, and it was going to be tough to really commit to the whole KHL in year one. And then, but year two to now, she's been with me the whole time, and life's been good. And I always said as soon as she says she's had enough of this, then that'll be it. But she's a trooper, and we've enjoyed it over here. So we'll keep going until they kick us out.
And as a player, this is not a bad league to be playing in. They don't throw 80 games at you. There isn't a playoff that takes you into June. Yes, you might get started a little earlier, but this is a very player-friendly schedule, is it not?
Absolutely. It's we don't even play back-to-back games. The schedule's been set up, so you play every other day. Most road trips are no longer than 4 or 5 games. I mean, there's breaks in the middle of the season for the Euro tours and all sorts of things that, like you said, make it super friendly on the player and the longevity of a player. And you know, playing 56 games this year, there'll be 60. It's hard to complain about something like that. You're still going to see all the teams, all the towns. There's still tons of rivalry games, but you're sticking away from playing those 3-3s that used to kill me in the American League and stuff like that. That, you know, it's as a player, when you're grinding it out, it just doesn't feel like there's the dog days of hockey over here quite as bad as I found in the American League.
It's a great point, because and then never mind the money. I mean, a guy making good money in the American League probably isn't even making $150,000, and you're right, you can play 3 games in 48 hours in that league. Meanwhile, in Russia, you mentioned the schedule, you never play back-to-back, you're not playing anywhere near 60 games, I don't think, and the money probably is 5 to 10-fold better than the American Hockey League for a similar caliber, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely, and the thing that can be mistaken for a lot of guys, I try to warn them coming over, is the money isn't there right away. And it's always tenure in this league. And you put your time in and you get rewarded as it goes. But the import guys, they don't like to reward them right off the bat unless you have obviously an extensive NHL resume. They want to see you come over and put your time and effort in and commit to the league. And then you're right, the money is there. But it's one of those leagues where you really got to commit to it, and you really got to go with the right frame of mind. And my buddies always give me a hard time about my frame of mind, but you got to be positive. You got to go in there thinking that fully committed to it, and you can really reap the benefits of it.
So, at what point were you considered a guy that had paid enough dues, that had tenure in the league? Was it after 3 years in Kazakhstan? Was it after a solid playoff performance your first year after leaving Kazakhstan? At what point did you start seeing, okay, teams are starting to back up the Brinks truck a bit here?
Yeah, it was probably after my year in Novosibirsk. It was, like you said, I had a good run in the playoffs, and actually I got to play Kari Ramo, who you guys are obviously too familiar with, and we had a good battle there in the playoffs and stuff like that, where you start to gain respect around the league. And that's probably when it started to all kind of come to fruition for me, and I really started to understand what the whole league was about. But with that being said, too, that had to move from a pretty comfortable setup in Astana to more of a volatile setup in Russia, where you're more treated like the business that it is, more so than, let's say, those teams that are outside of Russia.
Have you ever had money issues in terms of not getting paid? Has there been a tough time collecting? Have you had to get your agent to get lawyers to fight for money? You hear some of these horror stories, and it's not necessarily always the case, but some of the leagues in Europe, they'll cut you and pretend they don't know who you are.
Yep, and like I said, I don't want to get thrown on the bus too much here, but that was my whole season last year. Was we had a sponsor, and the sponsor was shut down mid-season, so literally... we went from a Thursday afternoon, we were informed that all of our bank accounts would be shut down, and the team literally ran dry. So from moving on from that point forward, we had no pregame meals at the rink, our pregame skates, we couldn't afford the ice time, we had to borrow money to take planes, we had to, you name it, our season, it was a mess. And those stories are true, there's not one team in the KHL that's profitable, and all these owners are giving away money every year, and so there's no way to recoup these losses once a team does start to go under, and once they do fold and the sponsors lost, the teams run dry, and I experienced that firsthand last year. So to answer all your questions, yes, yeah, for sure that does happen, and I've experienced it firsthand, and that's the downside of the league, and now you spend time trying to recoup what you lost, and hope that you can get somewhere close to the number you agreed on at the beginning of the season and move forward.
You've played all over the league, as we mentioned, a year in Kazakhstan, a couple last year split between two squads in Moscow. You're at an expansion team this year. You're up, I imagine, close to Siberia that one year after Kazakhstan. What was the worst travel in terms of each of those franchises, and what would be a trip that you'd never want to go through again? Because we had Jordan Henry on the other day. We talked to some guys from Croatia earlier in the week. We'll have Tyler Moss tomorrow, who's played your position in that league for a long time. Everyone's got a couple travel horror stories, it seems.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it, and I mean, I think we're covering 9 time zones, and flying from one side to the other is not fun, and you make it work. The horror stories can go on and on, but the funny ones I always laugh about is just moving around Moscow. Moscow's such a big city, and it's just congested, and you know, I think I've told stories before where it can take 4 hours to drive 15 minutes just because traffic's so bad and it's just come to a halt. And those stories in Moscow are honestly my favorite because I remember last year it took me 4 hours to get, like I said, 15 minutes home from the rink, and you can't even walk it because it's too far to walk and you don't move in the car and it just doesn't seem like you're getting anywhere. So traveling across the country is one story, but even traveling in the big cities is a whole other bag of worms.
And we talked about it a little bit yesterday. Moscow is one of the biggest cities on Earth. In fact, it's the biggest city in the world that isn't located on the ocean. You've got nasty winters. You've got over 100 billionaires living in the city. It's the second most expensive city to live in the world. Just the nuances of Moscow. How much did they raise your eyebrows coming over from North America to see this mega city in the middle of Russia?
It's unbelievable. I mean, it's only can be compared to a New York City or a Chicago. That's the only thing I've seen that's come close. It's like you said, the billionaires that hang out in the same sort of spots. It's so in your face every day, and I thoroughly enjoyed Moscow. It's one of my favorite cities in the world, and I really really enjoyed just people watching and just wandering around. And they have everything we're used to, the Starbucks, you name it over there. So that kind of stuff I really enjoyed. And Moscow as a city is pretty cool. I had my family come over at Christmas time last year to kind of experience it a little bit, and I think they're pretty blown away with just, like you said, how expensive things are and how much a show and go there is in that city.
Now, I heard something about Moscow. I would like you to debunk the myth or confirm what I've heard, that in a lot of places in Moscow, you don't hail a cab, you just get in a car with someone and start negotiating. Is that true or is that totally bogus?
100% true, yeah. No, and that happens all across Russia. We call them gypsy cabs. I don't know what the official term for them would be, but you flag them down. You hope you try not to sound too English because you know the rate's going to go up as soon as you do, and you try to put on your best Russian face and negotiate a rate, jump in with a guy, and hope for the best. And I've been doing it for 6 years, and at the beginning I was definitely a little bit nervous about it, but I'm starting to get the hang of it. And again, there's the horror stories that go with it, but for now, knock on wood, I've been lucky enough that my gypsy cabs have been friends to me, and I haven't had to get any tilts with any of these guys.
Jeff, fantastic catching up with you today. I know a lot of Calgarians excited to hear your story and the success you've had over there. I would say goodbye in Russian, but I have no idea how. If you have any Russian to say to anyone listening right now, this would be the time.
No, I don't even want to practice my Russian. It's morning, that's a double utro to everybody in Calgary.
All right, that sounds fantastic. Enjoy Italy. Have a great season with Togliatti, and I look forward to catching up with you when you're back in the spring.
Sounds good, guys. Thanks.
Macha Muchi Tugli Duty Calgary. That's Russian for make sure to put hot sauce on your omelet or something. I don't know. That was Jeff Glass. Great chatting with him from Italy this morning. He on a brand new expansion team in the KHL. Bit of shuffling. They lost Lev in Prague, a big team there. Also another team taking a year off. Donetsk in Ukraine moving. Lots of moving parts. Expansion team. The KHL is an interesting beast. And as we heard earlier in the week, a lot of things are quite normal over there. And as we heard today, oh yeah, last year, the sponsor of our team stopped paying us. They just stopped putting money in our bank accounts midway through the season. So it is certainly not yet a competitor to the NHL on that front. The financial footing not nearly as strong, at least for some of those teams. So we'll continue that tomorrow. Tyler Moss, a former Flames prospect, in studio at about 8 o'clock as we wrap up our week of KHL conversation. And we'll also hear from Wacy Rabbit on the phone line at around 9 o'clock. He's playing in Norway. I wanted to get a taste of exactly what he's up to over there and how the Norwegian League would compare to some of the others he's played in Europe. So, yes, we're doing the overseas hockey thing. It is going to be August tomorrow. It is July 31. And I suppose it would be appropriate to do a little stump the hump right now. Is that possible? Could we try to stump the hump? Good move. You want to do this, Josh? Are you ready? I can't stump the hump without you here. You need to turn on your microphone. There you are. Now you can talk into it. And I'll ask the questions. And you will say the answers into the microphone. And if they sound correct, you will win. It's a smorgasbord of questions today. I've got four questions for you. Smorgasbord? I don't know.
What is that?
It's German for bad buffet, I think. One's a true and false. Okay. And then I've got other trivia following. We got four questions in total, and I want to set the bar before we get into the questions. They're not immensely difficult. What's the standard for success today? Do you need to get 3 out of 4 correct, or do you need to get all four questions correct?
4 for 4. That's
got to go 4 for 4.
That's it.
Shoot for the stars. Aim high in life. You're a dream weaver, Josh.
As I do.
Nah. Okay. True or false is the first question. True or false, the Flames flag flew at the Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C., right next to the Maple Leaf during the Flames' run to the final in 2004. True or false, the Calgary True. Flames flag flew next to the Maple Leaf at the Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C.?
I'll say true.
That is correct. Well done, sir. So you're 1 for 1, 3 questions to go. Don't clap for yourself.
Someone's got to clap for me.
Not yet. You have to go 4 for 4, and then we'll give you a massive round of applause. Question number 2. Which two teams finished ahead of the Flames in the Northwest Division standings in the regular season? Which two teams in the Northwest Division finished above the Flames in the standings?
Vancouver.
That's correct. Vancouver had 101 points, top team in the Northwest Division that season, 2004, of course.
And it would have to be...
It's question two. He's getting trouble here.
Colorado?
That's correct. Colorado at 100 points. It was Vancouver, Colorado, Calgary. The two other teams in the division did not qualify for postseason play. The highest regular season scorer that the Flames faced in the playoffs was who? So, i.e., before the playoffs started, your regular season scoring leaders, who is the highest scoring regular season player that the Flames end up facing in the playoffs? There were some high-scoring guys. There were some guys on that Vancouver team that put up points. Yeah. There were some high-scoring guys in Detroit. San Jose had some players. Tampa had some stars. Which player had the most points in the regular season that the Flames ended up facing in the postseason?
Ooh. I don't know.
I have one clue for you.
Okay.
He won the scoring title that year with 38 goals, 56 points, 56 assists, and 94 points. Won the scoring race that year. I believe that is called the Art Ross Trophy.
Wasn't Robert Lang, was it? In Detroit?
Does Robert Lang have a bloody Art Ross Trophy? Give your head a shake.
Well, I know he was up there 1 year.
Oh, that's a horrible guess.
What about Vinny LeCavier?
That is incorrect. It was his teammate, Martin Saint-Louis. Josh, you've disappointed all of us, and you're riding your bike to work tomorrow as a result.
Three out of three.
Math, not your strong suit. Remember that Saskatchewan? You didn't take math 30?
Why would you if you don't need it?
I would suggest you may have just there. The Flames played four teams in the playoffs. Round one, Vancouver. Round two, Detroit. Round three, San Jose. Stanley Cup Final, Tampa Bay. Name the four coaches of the teams that year. Round by round.
Mark Crawford.
Correct.
Dave Lewis.
Correct.
Ron Wilson.
Correct.
John Tortorella.
Oh, my goodness. Well done. That was tough. I didn't think you were going to get Dave Lewis in Detroit. He had a small year there. He went from a small window where he wasn't an assistant prior to being fired as the head coach. So well done there. Dave Lewis was the head coach. Ron Wilson, Mark Crawford, John Tortorella. 3 for 4. And you do not get a massive round of applause. Not sure how we go tomorrow. Are these too hard for you? Do we have to make them easier?
No, those are all right. Only one wrong there. It's not bad.
Marty St. Louis, you thought Robert Lang won the scoring title.
Well, I know that Robert Lang was up there one year, and I couldn't remember if it was with
I didn't
Detroit
say up there. I said he won the scoring title. There's no Bob Lang on our Ross. I'm giving you a tough time, and the text line suggests we should get out of here and take a break. I'd rather listen to Paint Dry than you two idiots. I'm not sure how much noise paint drying makes sense, but I think I get the point you're trying to make. We'll come back and hear about a fantastic book called The Instigator. It's a biography on Gary Bettman. It's the only one that's ever been written. Jonathan Gatehouse, the author, next on Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
Talking sports in the morning. Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
McLean's Magazine and the author of a book entitled The Instigator, How Gary Bettman Remade the League and Changed the Game Forever. His name is Jonathan Gatehouse, and a good morning to you, sir.
Good morning to you, Ryan.
This is my favorite sports book I've read in the last couple years. I've got to compliment you on a fantastic biography on the NHL's commissioner.
Well, it's really kind of you, and the check's in the mail.
Is that what the publisher says? So that's like you're well-versed in that.
Exactly.
Tell us about how you got started on this project. Why in the world did you want to do this, and how did you get started? This seems awfully exhaustive. You talked to a lot of people along the way about Mr. Bettman.
Yeah, you know, actually it was the idea of my publisher at Penguin, my editor there, Nick Garrison, who's an old friend of mine, and he came to me and said, you know, no one's ever written a book on Bettman. And the more I thought about it and the more I looked into it, it made a lot of sense. You know, here was a guy, he'd been in charge of the league. He was coming up on his 20th anniversary when we started the project. And he was, you know, by far the most powerful figure that the game had ever seen. And he's made all these sorts of changes to the league over the course of his tenure. And then, of course, you know, two lockouts at the time we started, and by the time the book came out, it was three.
The timing was perfect in hindsight, because you're right. He was squaring off head-to-head with Donald Fair in his third labor stoppage, which pretty much, I mean, you cannot ignore that his legacy will involve some sort of conversation about work stoppages, but yet he had to win these wars for his owners.
Yeah, you know, listen, I don't think Bettman has never lost sight of who he works for. He doesn't work for the fans. He doesn't work for the game. It's not... You know, there's none of that mumbo-jumbo that was associated with the baseball commissioner or the idea that it was an independent position. His employers are the 30 owners of the NHL teams, and, you know, ultimately, you know, it's good for the business to have a healthy game, and it's good for the business to have 30 competitive teams, but in the end of the day, it's about making money for the owners.
Exactly what state was the league in before he arrived? How Mickey Mouse mom-and-pop shop was the NHL?
Well, you know, at the tail end of John Ziegler's reign as president, he wasn't commissioner, because that was the title that Bettman was the first to get. The NHL was a $400 million a year business. You know, to put that in perspective for your listeners, this year they came awfully close to $3.7 billion. Next year, I think everybody believes that they're going to $4 billion. So it's an incredible growth in the state of the game. I mean, when Bettman took over, it was a 2016 league. It was, you know, you had unhealthy franchises. You had a number of them that were on the cusp of moving. You know, we saw Quebec City and Winnipeg leave early in his tenure. I mean, you know, there was a lot of the game was in flux, and certainly when you look at it, you can't dismiss those three labor stoppages and the effect that they had on the fans. But the business is a lot healthier than it was when he took over.
How healthy is it with this 50-50 revenue split down from 57% prior to the work stoppage?
Well, I think it's very healthy for the owners. And I think, you know, I think fans look at it and still see the size of the contracts and think that it's not so bad for most of the players either. You know, I don't think that precludes at some point further down the line the owners getting even greedier and saying that they need it to be, you know, 55-45 or something. But for the moment, you know, we've got some peace at least for the next nine seasons.
One of the things that you sort of you continue to be reminded of in this book is that Gary Bettman does not back down, and Gary Bettman has a memory like an elephant. Does he not?
He does. He can hold a grudge with the best of them, and you know, and he's that kind of, in a way, the classic little man with a big chip on his shoulder. I mean, he came from a relatively humble background, a broken family. Raised by his mother out on Long Island, Queens, and then Long Island, and you know, he's always been striving and trying to prove himself, and you know, and to this day, I think that remains a huge part of his personality.
And it seems like those who work around him absolutely hold his work ethic and his ability to prepare for a battle in immensely high regard.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, I mean, I wouldn't want to work for Gary Bettman, and I imagine you wouldn't either. I mean, he is a 24/7 sort of guy. It's not uncommon. He sleeps 4 hours a night. It's not uncommon to get emails from him, you know, in the wee hours of the morning, and often they're about very small details. You know, his mastery of files that he's involved with, especially anything to do with sort of contractual or business arrangements. His background as a lawyer, I mean, he's very smart, you know, he's very well prepared, and he's tenacious to the extreme.
I wonder what, you know, we're all curious about how this started with hockey. He was clearly an NBA guy, he's got a legal background, but I liked you shed some light on that he was kind of a hockey fan when he was going to college. He was always fond of the sport, if not competing in the sport.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when he was at university, his Ivy League school. I mean, hockey was a big part of where he went, and you know, he says he has season tickets to watch it. That he even tried to play once or twice. You know, again, I'm not, you know, and that he did tell me that he remembers taking the bus and going down and or the subway and going down and watching Rangers games and sitting up in the cheap seats as a kid by himself and doing his homework. So I think in the end, you know, that notion that he had no connection with the game is a bit oversold. You know, is he does he live and breathe it the way that the Canadians do? No, that's not the truth either.
How is he perceived in this country, and where do maybe the perception, is it farthest off base from who he actually is?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, in certain segments of this country, he could be ranked among history's greatest monsters. I think that's probably a little off base, if not a lot off base. I mean, it's a funny job, right? I mean, the commissioner of the NHL, in many ways, he's more powerful than a lot of provincial premiers in Canada. He's better recognized than a lot of federal politicians, and he's got more, you know, arguably more impact on people's day-to-day lives than a lot of those folks. So he's, you know, I think people have tended to look at him as an all-purpose villain and somebody who embodies the things that they don't like about hockey. But I think, you know, a fairer analysis, and that's, you know, part of what the book was about, is that it's certainly, he has done some positive things for the game, and certainly when it comes to Canada and the Canadian franchises, you know, as people, certainly people at West would remember, I mean, he's done a lot to make sure in those dark days in the 90s when the currency was plunging and a lot of Canadian teams were in trouble, he did a lot to make sure that more of them didn't move.
And you mentioned the market he might be most popular in is one that's seen the most turmoil in the last decade, half decade. He's revered in Phoenix.
Yeah, I think you know that too will pass as time goes on and people get to concentrate more on hockey. But yeah, I think the fans, the core of fans there, and you know, to be truthful, it's not a huge core, but there are fans there. They certainly appreciate the efforts that he's gone to, the lengths to which he's gone to make sure that that hockey remains in Phoenix.
What were your communications like with Bettman through the process? And I'm sure at some point you probably want to mention to the guy you're writing a biography about that you're going to do so. What was his reaction to that you would be the first guy to write a book on him?
Well, you know, I went and knocked on the front door. I didn't start the book until I'd actually contacted him. And, you know, I had discussions through, you know, various intermediaries at the NHL and sort of said, listen, that I want to do this. I'm not coming in with a preconceived notion. I'm not a, you know, hockey's not what I write about on a regular basis. I write about politics. I write about, you know, amateur sports and other things for McLean's. But, you know, I didn't have a history with him, though I'd spoken to him a couple times. And, you know, I said, listen, I just want to tell the full story and talk to a lot of people and look at both sides of the ledger. And, you know, I got a positive response in that. And he, you know, the thing about Gary was he didn't stand in my way, and he's really capable of doing that for people that he's got a problem with. But, you know, he was really good. He made sure I knew that when I would call somebody for this book, the first thing that would happen is that they would pick up the phone or dash off an email to Bettman and say, hey, this guy wants to talk. Can I talk to him? And, you know, and I found that nobody was told no. Everybody was said, sure, you know. Give him some cooperation, and in the end, I think it really helped me out.
Were you surprised that he was that open to you writing a book, however you wanted to? Because he does. If you called him a control freak, people wouldn't say you're over. You know, that's overstating things. He does like to control every single detail, and this is a biography about him himself.
Yeah, you know, he's very capable of arguing his own case. I mean, that's the thing about him. And in fact, I think it's one of his greatest faults is that he. Anybody who's ever really dealt with him, and certainly I've experienced this as well. I mean, I always say it's a good Gary, bad Gary, right? He can be extremely charming. He can be very solicitous, and certainly a lot of the people that work for him will tell you, you know, of real humanity on his part, of a caring person who's big on fans and things like that. But at the same time, if you deal with him in a professional capacity, certainly it's a true. You know, he's the kind of guy who takes umbrage at the questions that he's asked. He likes to pick apart what he feels are suppositions that you're making. It's very, very lawyerly, and I think it does him a real disservice, particularly when he's on television. It's one of those reasons that, you know, I think people watch him on TV and they come away with an impression that this guy is, you know, is not the guy that they like.
He does almost come across as that used car salesman guy where you want to talk about one thing and he slides the conversation elsewhere, and he's got these prepackaged answers. He looks a little slippery. He never really did get along with Ron McLean's line of questioning very well.
No, you know, and that's a particular pathology between the two of them. I think, you know, Bettman has always felt like that there's a certain lack of respect for him and for the league. And, you know, while I think he's been willing to tolerate that to a certain extent south of the border, where they know where they are in the pecking order, here in Canada, I think he feels that a little more acutely. And certainly, you know, he certainly had great difficulty with those McLean interviews. He hasn't talked to him, I think, since 2010, and I don't imagine he ever will again. And, you know, it really was about a sense that they were somehow disrespectful, that putting your broadcast, your sports partner on the hot seat and needling them year after year was something that, you know, wouldn't happen to, what Fox wouldn't do to, you know, to the commissioner of baseball or another network wouldn't do to the commissioner of the NFL.
It's a fair point. It's funny. We talked about Phoenix. The fans absolutely adore him there because he's kept the team there. And if you were a previous owner of the Coyotes, like Jerry Moyes, who made all his money in trucking and then probably lost it all trying to own the Coyotes, or if you're someone that works at City Hall in Glendale, or if you're someone from the that pays taxes in that area, I mean, he can be pretty ruthless as well. It wasn't all everything rosy, especially in that market. He would be seen as a villain by many there too.
Oh, absolutely. Listen, I mean, that Glendale deal, let's not beat around the bush. That's about the worst deal ever for the taxpayers of Glendale. And it's astounding, you know, that they were ever hoodwinked into signing it and to continuing to throw good money or after bad, you know, for those 2 years or almost three before they found somebody to come in and buy that franchise. I mean, the taxpayers of Glendale were paying $25 million a year to subsidize that team. I mean, it's ridiculous. And they've, but, you know, they're, they're wedded to that, and they don't want to lose the team. And, you know, Bettman had taken advantage of that. He drove a hard bargain.
We are chatting with Jonathan Gatehouse, the author of The Instigator, How Gary Bettman Remade the League and Changed the Game Forever. If there's one thing I wished about this book, I wish you wrote it a year later so we could hear about this Rogers purchase of the entire rights of NHL packages, including the rights to play highlights on other channels. How all-encompassing and one-of-a-kind is a deal like this?
It really is. I don't think there's any sort of model. It's a groundbreaking thing. I mean, it's something that certainly other leagues are going to be looking at, and it flew against what the conventional wisdom was, right? The idea was that you do what the NFL has done and try to get as many broadcasters as possible involved, all competing against each other for a slice of the pie. I think, you know, most people in Canada, myself included, believe that what we were going to end up with, Rogers ended up taking it. They were going to get, you know, a game of the week, like on Sunday night or something. But it's breathtaking, the scale of this deal, and it's breathtaking the amount of money. $5.2 billion for 12 years is major league money coming out of the Canadian market.
It's huge dough. Is there any way that you could see this not working for Rogers? And I know this is the company that owns me, and I have no idea how this works. This is way north of my pay grade. But is it possible they paid too much for rights? We've seen some NFL deals where broadcasters will say, we can at least for the promotional value break even and come out ahead because they'll hang around for our other shows. Is it in that territory, or is this the safest thing in the world, betting on Canadians watching hockey?
Well, I mean, listen, they own the Canes as well, so let's both hope that it works out. But I don't know. You know, it's one of those things. CBC would always say that that they broke even, more or less, on money in, money out in terms of advertising for Hockey Night in Canada. But we've seen what's happened with CBC losing that revenue, right? I mean, they've had to make incredible cuts to their news services and to their staffing levels. So really, there was more of an impact than just dollar in, dollar out. Rogers is different. You know, there's a subscription-based service with the Sportsnet channels. It's content for that. It's content for a lot of other platforms than the Rogers, not just radio, but, I mean, you know, mobile phones and iPads and, you know, and even, you know, there's going to be content in the magazine, certainly in Sportsnet magazine and in McLean's too. So the cost is spread across a lot of different outlets. It's a bet. It's an audacious bet that, you know, but if the price of sports keeps going up the way it has, 12 years from now, I'm not so sure that it won't look like a good bet.
It's unbelievable. Every time we see these TV deals, they're landmarks, they're record-breaking, and then the next time the deals come up, they are astronomically greater in value. I can't imagine what the next NFL contracts are going to look like because the last ones were eye-popping.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, this is just it. I mean, you would think at a certain point the expansion has got to slow or has got to end or the bubble burst, but right now, it's incredibly valuable to both networks and to advertisers because sports is the only thing pretty much that you can guarantee that people are going to sit down and watch live. They're not going to PVR it. They're not going to fast forward through your commercials. They're not going to, you know, tune in at some later point. And, you know, as I say, now I think what the NHL really liked about this deal was the fact that, one, that it was, you know, everything was in one place, that all the games are going to be available, you know, kind of across the country. And then, two, that, you know, that it really was pushing the envelope in terms of technology, and that's where I think the NHL has always seen the growth. That, you know, that this is mobile platforms and getting people to watch non-traditional ways.
When it all was said and done, how long did it take from spinning the idea, or at least pitching the idea to Bettman and the league itself, to the finished copy being available on bookshelves? How long was that process for you?
Oh God, it felt like forever. I think I researched the book for about, I don't know, 10 months. And then I sat down and I took 4 months off of work and I wrote almost all of it in the 4 months and then wrote another chapter afterwards. And then last summer I went back and added an update about the lockout and the fallout of the lockout for the paperback edition. So, you know, it's a long process.
And did you ever get feedback from Bettman? I'm sure he read this thing as soon or even before it was available, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, I sat down with Gary last summer in Boston, just before the or during the Stanley Cup Finals there, and so I got some feedback from him. I mean, you know, it wasn't as bad as I'd been led to believe. I'd been softened up and told that I was going to get the most detailed and persnickety book report of all time. In the end, you know, he made a few points. The one that really stuck with me was that I had said that, you know, he's always pretended that he doesn't mind when people boo him, and he took issue with that because I said that in the book that that actually I felt like he really did mind and that you could see it, and he took issue and brought that up and said, you know, you say this, but that's not true, and you know, it proves to me that you don't get me. And I thought, well, geez, if there's anything that proves that you did get someone, that you've nailed it more than them saying, you know, taking umbrage at that, is I didn't know what it was. So.
I don't have thin skin. Look at me objecting to the book you wrote about me. I don't have thin skin.
I really upset that you said I have a thin skin. Exactly. So.
Yeah, so I think you made your point there. You probably win that battle. Jonathan, an absolute pleasure reading this book. Nice catching up with you. I would recommend all our listeners that can read, which is most of them, to read the book, The Instigator, How Gary Bettman Remade the League and Changed the Game Forever. Congratulations on a great piece of work, and I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks very much, Ryan. It was a pleasure.
That is Jonathan Gatehouse, and again, highly recommended book, How Gary Bettman Remade the League and Changed the Game Forever. The only bio on Bettman, and a nice added section at the end that Jonathan referenced post work stoppage. He's added the new chapter at the back. So still very, very current. Gets into the X's and O's, nuts and bolts of a lot of the business of the league and growth and revenues. He's projecting over $4 billion this year the NHL will make. That's an incredibly huge number. And yeah, when he started, it was a $400 million league. It was peanuts then compared to what it is now. A tenfold growth over the two decades he's run the league. So pretty impressive. We'll break when we come back. It is what you want to talk about. 960-960 on your cell phone. Bring us the love, the hate, your questions and comments. It is Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
Interact right now. Text 960-960 to sound off. Sportsnet 960. The Fan.
.948 on your Thursday. It is Major League Baseball trade deadline day, at least the non-waiver trade deadline. Feels like it takes an hour to explain that, but essentially deals can be made beyond today. But a player will have to be placed on waivers, and then the other team claims them, and if the wrong team claims them, they're revocable waivers, you take them off. It's really boring. All you need to know is there's things are happening. A couple deals the Oakland A's have made today. They pick up John Lester from the Red Sox, as well as Johnny Gomes in exchange for Yoenis Cespedes, the Cuban slugger. He'll like his new home in Fenway Park. He won't like leaving a team that is the best in the majors, in my opinion, to one that will miss the playoffs. They also made another deal with all the pitchers they've added in recent weeks. Samardzija, Hamels. Is it Hamels or Hamel? Plural, singular? Paging Josh.
That is the plural one.
Hamels. Jason Hamels?
Jason Hamel.
Hamel. Okay, so singular. Very good. So they've added Samardzija, Lester, Hamel. And so, yeah, they got some arms. They send Tommy Malone to the Twins for Sam Fold, who I believe is with the Athletics earlier this year. Bit of a minor deal, but Oakland's got a rotation. They lose a bit of a bat in their lineup, but they can pitch. No one's going to outpitch Oakland. Whether that means they're World Series bound and the best team in the AL in the playoffs, I have no idea. Last year, it was the two best offenses that met in the World Series. It wasn't about pitching staffs. But that changes. Other years, it's the exact opposite. Other deals of note? Anything caught your eye out there in terms of trades around the majors?
Nothing's come across yet. There's a few rumors. Emilio Bonifacio scratched today by the Cubs. He's a utility player that I think there's a lot of teams that would like him. He's kind of resurged his career.
He'd be a good bench guy, right?
Really good bench guy.
If you're a playoff team, yeah. You can pinch run that guy in the eighth inning when you're down by a run. That's a good thing.
Yeah, he'll draw some interest from some teams today for sure. But yeah, aside from that, that's about it.
No word on any moves from the Blue Jays as of yet. But keep in mind, they will return Lind, Encarnacion, and Lowry probably in that order, which feels like three pretty major additions to a lineup that has already gone 10-3 in their last 13 games. We'll have the game tonight at 6 o'clock, live from Houston, right from first pitch here on Sportsnet 960 The Fan. It'll also be on Sportsnet West. Looking for a sixth consecutive victory are the Blue Jays. Stamps notes, they've released a roster and depth charts for tomorrow night's contest against the BC Lions. 8 o'clock start, McMahon. The big news, Nick Lewis out. But some good news as well in terms of players returning from injury.
Yep, Jabari Arthur back in the lineup. That's huge for the Stampeders. Keon Raymond on a defensive back for the Stampeders. That's going to be big. Defense that's already been playing well is going to get a little bit better. And a Martel Mallett, kind of returning from injury, but he's also going to make his season and Stamps debut at the running back position.
I think it's his first start since 2009 in the CFL as a running back. So
2009 was in his rookie of the year.
He hasn't started since then, is that right?
No, he's played after that. 2009 is when he won the rookie of the year.
All right, well, I'm just making up stats. It's his first start since Roosevelt was the president.
Yes.
Yeah, there you are. Something like that. Other news before we get to what you want to talk about? Nothing breaking on P.K. Subban yet?
Nope. Nothing coming
If you haven't read Elliot Friedman's article on CBC Sports, you should. Quite good. Analyzing from both sides. You got to think this thing gets done, and yet here we are a day away from the arbitration hearing between P.K. Subban and the Habs. I'd be shocked if they don't do something long-term because they're just going to have the same problem next year. Guess what? Cap's going to go up again the year after. Why pay more then? Pay the man now and end up saving you money down the road. Did you learn anything from the bridge deal you signed him to?
Yeah. Get it done now, long-term.
Keep that guy locked up. So with that behind us, let us move along to the most scintillating 8 minutes of radio. It is called Talk about. From the text line at 960-960, we read your texts. That is the entire segment. The Dodgers still have a better rotation than the Athletics. That from the text line. Probably, but no one in the AL is close to Oakland in my mind.
No.
And, yeah, LA's rotation is pretty nasty. Josh, please teach Pinder how to say Cespedes. How are you saying it? Because that's how I say it.
Yoannis Cespedes, not Cespedes.
How's your Spanish? Have you ever taken Spanish classes?
No, we're not in Cuba or Spain, and we're not down south right now, so you're in Canada.
Oh, so I say his name Cepedes? Is that how I say it? Because I'm in Canada?
No, Yoannis Cespedes.
Cespedes. I'm sticking with it. Sorry,
you don't
folks.
Need to put the accent on.
Well, if you can speak the language.
Yeah, but you're Canadian.
You don't say bonjour, you say bonjour. We'll move along. Elsewhere on the text line, Mars Volta for Artist of the Day tomorrow. Wow, that's a bit of a reach. I haven't heard Mars Volta for a while. I don't know. That might be a little extreme for the... although, Chromio, I knew I was going to get beat up a bit. I did. Robert Lang. that from the text line. Marcus Naslund was a top five scorer that year as well. He had a big, big season points-wise. Surprised you went Bob Lang. That was weird.
He was up. I knew he was in the top couple of years. I can't remember if he had won it or if he was there, if it was Detroit or if it was Washington days. But
well, go ahead and research it, and you tell me how close he got to Art Ross.
So,
I can't wait for the results. I hope you bozos aren't taking a paycheck for the last hour of the show because you have done nothing. Yeah, we don't get an extra bonus check for working 9 till 10, even though all the other morning shows in the building are done at 9. So, no, we don't get any extra money for that. That's why you get the scintillating 6:40 and 7 o'clock interviews. Although it was kind of cool to hear from Jeff Glass. I learned more about the KHL today. That interests me. It might not interest others. I don't know how that resonates with you. Jays need to dump Lind. Play Tenacious D tomorrow. I could do Tenacious D. I don't know if the lyrics would keep my... I'd allowed to keep my job after that, but I'm not going to commit to doing it, but I would. That is the band name I would entertain. Is Brett Laurie a Band-Aid? Think they should move him? I wouldn't move Brett Laurie. He started to show a bit of pop in that bat in terms of home runs and doubles. He can steal bases when he's healthy. He plays phenomenal defense. He can play second. He can play third. And if you're playing him at second base, try to find me another second baseman that can do the things he does defensively and offensively. That's a pretty rare blend of power and skill at second. Normally, you get a pretty weak hitter at second base. There's not a lot of prolific hitters that play second. It's a defense-first position. He could provide both. Tool for Artist of the Day. That's a little aggressive. No. Jays acquire David Price, according to Pinder. No, that's not true. I did not report that.
That wasn't you?
No. I don't mind the trade for Boston. They're in dire need of an outfielder, and with Cespedes in left field at Fenway, it's a good thing. He's got a great arm. There's going to be a lot of guys gunned down at second base. You're in Canada, Pinder. Learn how to talk. Josh is right. I should take some talking lessons from Josh. We'll try to set up a time and place for that. The CFL needs to do something about dirty hits. Rolling over and piling on needs to go. What league allows its star players to be targeted? I'm tired of the no-name replacements. It's a fantastic text. You know what league does allow their star players to get injured with zero repercussions? It's called the Canadian Football League. Visit their website at CFL.ca. Send your letters to the commissioner, Mark Cohan. It might be an eight-team league too soon. Eight-team league as well, very soon. Toronto is a complete disaster. Pinder, do you know what happened to Captain Kirk, who used to do the traffic reports? I have no idea.
Internal business that won't be discussed.
Maybe the helicopter ran out of gas. I don't know. Jays need to trade Rasmus while he can
Exploded bag of garbage.
Yeah, see, then we have Sue. You don't like Sue? Where else would we get our bag of garbage up
We to? Had some reports of big bags of insulation that fell off a truck. Well, the truck driver stopped, picked up the bags of insulation, reloaded, and has since moved on.
Like, I can't live without that. I need that. Stroman is the next Todd Van Poppel. Signed, Pinder. Boy, we're getting really obscure with the text that I'm allegedly sending into my own show here today.
You are all over the Stroman, though.
Hey, I was on him from start one. I watched the entirety of that start. I believe it was a Saturday. And he's been their best starter since then, and he could win Rookie of the Year. It's been stunning how good he's been. First rounder for a couple of years ago. Hey, Pinder, you got to give us a Don Cherry impression, please. Do I do a Don Cherry impression?
Go ahead.
It's the off season. Don's at the cabin.
Don's not working.
Let's go. Is the NFL coming to Toronto? No, but I think Buffalo, it's in their best interest financially to keep a relationship with Toronto. I don't know necessarily whether it's bringing games to the Rogers Center, but if you're a Buffalo owner, whether that is Terry Pegula or some other group down the road, you've got to find a way to embrace that Toronto market. Somehow capitalize on your proximity to a huge city in North America that does not have an NFL team. I hate you both from the text line.
Hey, Pinder, you suck. Sign Pinder.
Oh, there another text from me. On fire right now. NFL predictions. How bad will Dallas be? Well, if Dallas has taught us anything, they're probably good for 8-8 every year. They are the definition of mediocre. Mickey Oder. As they say. No one says that. Pinder, you forgot about that guy in Chicago for Rookie of the Year. Yeah, Abreu has been really good. That's a good point. And Pinder, don't forget about Funk Fridays tomorrow. It makes Friday even better. I'm going to see if I can find a funk band or an album or a compilation that we can get to. Narrow it down a little. We are out of Fruit Loops. Signed, Pinder's sister. Again. My sister does not sign texts, Pinder's sister. She has a name, just like you would sign your name at the end of a text. She doesn't say Pinder's sister. By the way, her last name is Pinder as well, or at least it was before she got married, so saying Pinder's sister is somewhat redundant there. How does Bo Levi feel about Drew Tate? He's a team first guy. We know that.
Good relationship.
I think his strong feelings are evoked when he's asked about the South and maybe about what kind of foods and where he's from. I believe it's Katy, Texas, if I'm correct, where he's from. A reminder, 6 o'clock, Jays, Astros. We've got your first pitch tonight, shortly after 6 on Sportsnet 960 The Fan. It is also on Sportsnet West. Jays look for a 6th victory in a row. They are 3 games up on Seattle and New York for the second wild card in the AL and just 2.5 back of Baltimore. It's still a few days away, but you get the sense next week's series against the Baltimore Orioles in Toronto starting on Tuesday could be absolutely huge in terms of where they finish down the stretch. But then again, they still do have 14 games remaining against Baltimore, Seattle, and New York combined before the end of the season. Those 14 games will certainly go a long way in determining whether there's a pennant, whether there's playoffs, or whether there's a call for people to be fired in Toronto by the end of the season. That's it for our time. It is Big Show at 1 o'clock. And again, Blue Jays baseball at 6. We'll do it all again tomorrow. Can't wait. We'll have Tyler Moss in studio. He's living and working in Calgary now. Spent tons of time in the K. We'll chat with him. Stephen Brunt apparently has a bear in his backyard. We'll figure that out. And we're chasing more audio from Stamps Lions. It's a game day tomorrow. Sportsnet 960 The Fan.